Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Degrees.
From WBUR in Boston and WRNI in Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Shouldn't the minimum wage be enough to live on? If the answer seems clear, the reality is anything but. $5.15 an hour isn't enough to cover rent or groceries, much less to raise a family. Across the country, cities are requiring employers to pay more than the minimum wage. In this hour, the war over the living wage, adding up the costs and benefits of social decency. The program with news from Washington. As the search for missing Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl continues in Pakistan, the Bush administration has adopted a new policy that would allow the U.S. to act more rigorously in hostage cases. Judith Miller broke the story for the New York Times. Earlier, I asked her to describe the new policy.
For one thing, before, an American who happened to be a private citizen as opposed to a government official might not be, his case might not be reviewed by a hostage subgroup at the National Security Council. Reviews were done on a very ad hoc basis. If a military person or a government official was seized, for sure, this hostage subgroup, as it's called, would look at the case and decide whether or not the government should get involved. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And the government, the Bush administration, wanted to ensure that in all cases involving Americans overseas, there would at least be a review of the case to see whether or not American government intervention was warranted, and if so, what kind of intervention was appropriate. And so that's a kind of guarantee for Americans overseas, and I think it's going to be a welcome one for most Americans operating, some of them in very difficult, high-risk situations overseas. You know, your message, your government cares.
Yes. But I gather the Pentagon had a different feeling that somehow this would heighten the value of American hostages.
Right. The term that Secretary Rumsfeld was reported to me to have used was would heighten their market value to the hostage taker. And I have to say that, you know, everyone agreed that this was a concern, but that they thought on balance that treating all Americans equally in terms of the right to a review was actually a more important principle. Mm-hmm. And I think also the notion sometimes that some agencies argue that, well, we shouldn't get involved because it's just a private citizen or an oil worker in Colombia, that really didn't advance American goals and it didn't send the right message to some hostage takers who just thought it would be kind of easy pickings to take an American and the companies would pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, what this policy now says is that if you take an American hostage, you are potentially picking a fight with the United States. And I think the State Department argued that that might deter a large part of the hijacking incidents. Now, we know that there are about 20 to 25 cases involving Americans overseas a year. So this is quite important. And what the administration was worried about was the fact that this trend is growing and that Americans are increasingly at risk. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that's happened is that, and this the administration was never intending to publicize because of this problem about heightening the market value or increasing the market value of Americans overseas, is that before, under the old policy, the official policy said the U.S. government doesn't pay ransom and doesn't make concessions. And you know, the company whose employee has been hijacked, or the, you know, you, the family whose loved one has been taken, if you pay, if you make concessions, we're not going to have anything to do with you. Mm-hmm. Now, that was the policy, but it wasn't respected. The American government, in some instances, did get involved when ransom was paid. What the Bush administration has now said is that we still discourage the paying of ransom, and the U.S. government will not pay it. But if you, the company, or the family feel that you have no other choice to get your loved one released and you pay it, we are not going to walk away from you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll strongly discourage you from doing it, mm-hmm. but we're going to be there and provide assistance. And I think that, too, is a move towards much greater pragmatism
right.
and ending this kind of gap between the theory and the reality of what these situations are like overseas.
You mentioned one of them, that of Ronald Sander,
yes.
an American oil worker kidnapped in Ecuador. And you say that he was the first American, quote, administration official saying he's the first American life lost to terrorism under the Bush administration, and that his fate had a profound impact on Condoleezza Rice and perhaps on this policy. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I just know that the White House was involved in that situation in terms of monitoring the case. This was one that the government did pay attention to, and some officials felt very strongly that a rescue operation ought to be tried and that a more aggressive action ought to be taken, and others didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this incident and the fact that the companies were kind of on their own in deciding how they were going to handle it, whether or not they were going to pay ransom and how much they were going to pay, that the delay involved in getting a speedy response, some people felt was responsible, could may have been a contributing factor to Sanders' death. And I know that in terms of, you know, the mood at the White House, it was very, very grim.
And the United States used the ransom to go to the kidnappers and finally got 57 of them.
Finally.
So that's
right
sort of the model
that.
Of how the new policy might work. Is that it?
That's right. And mm-hmm. the others, but after the others were freed, the
yeah.
other four were freed.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing about that case is that, you know, it really was a very sophisticated operation, a very sophisticated kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys really knew what they were doing, and yet they were caught and they were apprehended, and they will not benefit from that ransom payment. And I think that's the overall message that the administration is trying to send.
Judith Miller is a reporter for the New York Times. Earlier this month, New Orleans voters passed a referendum that adds $1 an hour to the federal minimum wage. Local businesses vow to fight the new ordinance, and New Orleans isn't the only city thus embroiled. The battle over the living wage is being fought across the country. Are you willing to pay more at McDonald's so workers can earn more? Will the living wage cost jobs? Who should decide how much it costs to live anyway? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Robert Polin. He's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book The Living Wage, Building a Fair Economy. Good evening, Robert Polin.
Good evening to you.
Now, Robert Polin, you played a role in this New Orleans campaign. Could you briefly describe your part in it and maybe give us some anecdotes, the human face of this struggle?
Well, I was asked by the supporters of the living wage in New Orleans to conduct a study that would give some objective basis for the debate. There really weren't any numbers. No one had really studied what the impact would be. Yet, the state legislature of Louisiana had already passed a law which prohibited any municipality in the state of Louisiana from passing a measure that would, quote, be harmful to the state of the economy of the state of Louisiana. And
mm-hmm.
And the courts had upheld a judgment that said, well, you can't even vote on such a measure, a living wage measure for New Orleans, because it's going to be, quote, harmful to the state of Louisiana's economy. But they had no evidence for this. This was back in 1999, and so that's why I was commissioned to do this study, which was to provide some modicum of objectivity as to the costs and benefits of this measure. And I did this study, and you know, it's been 3 years now, so or 2.5 years. So that was how I got involved in it.
You say the costs and benefits. Let's start with the benefits, and we'll get to the costs.
Okay. Well, I mean, the main point is in New Orleans and throughout the country, there's been this living wage movement, which effectively is a very simple thing. It's just a way to raise the minimum wage because the national minimum wage is extremely low. The national minimum wage remains today at $5.15 an hour, though some states, including our state, Massachusetts, have a higher wage at minimum of Massachusetts being $6.75. But anyway, the national minimum wage at $5.15 is about 40% below what it was 30 years ago. In today's dollars, the national minimum wage was $8.15 in 1968. That meant the lowest worker starting on the first day of a job coming in, if they were going to be paid a legal wage, had to be paid minimum $8.15. That was 33 years ago. Today it's $5.15. So the impact has been that working people are having an increasingly hard time getting by. And poverty, the use of homeless shelters, soup kitchens by people with jobs is just a reality that gets documented year after year. And so the living wage movement, in terms of the benefits, is really just to make it viable for somebody with a low-paying job to still live a life of dignity and raise a family.
And we'll get to the costs, I think, with our next guest. But let's just keep on with you for a minute. Now, New Orleans, of course, in a certain respect, this was kind of a free vote, wasn't it? I mean, that is to say, New Orleans has a primarily tourist economy. The people who were voting on the ordinance wouldn't be staying in the hotels where prices might rise. They wouldn't be patronizing the tourist shops, those T-shirts and so on, where tourists buy things. So, in other words, this is a model that makes sense in a Santa Monica and a New Orleans where other people primarily will be paying the higher prices that might result. But is this something that, say, Cleveland or Buffalo?
Well, first, let me just give you a little bit of the evidence that I conducted a very extensive survey of businesses in New Orleans. That's what the main thing I did. So the evidence that I have was given to me directly by the businesses themselves. And the main question I wanted to get at was the question you were getting at yourself, which is, well, how much are their costs going to go up if they pay workers this living wage of $6.15? And the answer was, on average, the cost would go up 0.9%, less than 1%. That was in 1999. Since then, 2.5 years of inflation and so forth, that average cost per firm is lower. It's probably more like 0.6% now. So we're talking about, on average, a cost increase on the order of 0.5% to 1% for the average firm. So when we say the hotels are going to, you know, have to charge more, they are. They may well charge more, but that cost increase, the price increase, is going to be very modest. It's going to be, you know, 1% more, maybe 1.5% more. It is not going to be a dramatic increase such that tourists are going to say, well, we're not going to New Orleans now because the you know, the prices are too high there.
Yeah, and it's a sort of inelastic attraction too, isn't it? I mean, people are going to go to New Orleans practically regardless.
Well, they're not going to go if they say, look, you know, it's going to cost us 25% more to go to New Orleans than it is going to go to, I don't know, Miami. But if it's 1%, you know, those kinds of small cost differences come out in the wash. They're not substantial, and there are other factors that are influencing prices. For example, if workers are paid a little bit more, then their commitment to their job goes up.
So it's turnover goes down.
Yeah, their turnover goes down. Absenteeism goes down. It's not necessarily the case that the firms would even raise their prices 1% to make up the difference.
So that's what you might say is the latent benefit to the employer in raising the wage. Thanks, Robert Poland. We'll come right back to you. We're talking about the living wage this hour. On Point, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. We'll be right back. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the living wage this hour, focusing on New Orleans, where voters recently voted a dollar increase in the minimum wage for all workers in the city, except government workers, and for all employers. Our guest is Robert Poland, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and the author of The Living Wage, Building a Fair Economy. And now we're joined on the line by David Newmark. He's a professor of economics at Michigan State University. Hello, David Newmark.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Well, fine. Nice to talk to you again. 1% increase in prices, David Newmark, that doesn't sound like a job killer to me.
I think it's got to be thought of in a different light. When a minimum wage or a living wage goes up, there's two things that happen, right? One is a business's costs go up and the business might have to raise its prices, and therefore it might sell a little less of whatever it produces. Mm-hmm. That's one effect. And I agree, that is likely to be small, although I'd like to come back to this 1% number. But the other thing a business does, irrespective of that, is tends to use less of whatever input, in this case cheap labor, that now is more expensive, and more of some other inputs. And that you can still get a pretty big response along those dimensions. Right, so I don't think the problem is that people are going to buy a lot less McDonald's hamburgers, mm-hmm. but that McDonald's establishments who are covered by this law might start to say, well, maybe we should use somewhat fewer high school dropouts who perhaps were earning $5.15 currently, and perhaps a little more management or a little more equipment or machinery or whatever the case might be. Mm-hmm. One example I always like to give when I teach about this with respect to fast food restaurants is the example of soda dispensers, right? It used to be in a fast food restaurant, you walked in, you ordered a medium drink, and the employee went over and held the button till the medium cup was filled at the top. And then sure. after that, they had machines with three buttons, right? So they'd go over and they'd hit the medium button, and it would fill just the right amount, and that worker could go do something else, grab your fries, whatever. So labor saving. And mm-hmm. now, of course, they just give you a cup, right? And you get your own drink. So that's the kind of thing that happens mm-hmm. over time when we do this. And the price increase is not really what's driving it, but it's the relative price of low-skilled labor versus either higher-skilled labor or other inputs like equipment or machinery.
Now, I seem to recall a couple of years ago that an Alan Krueger, now at Princeton, did a study of the proposition of what job loss through the minimum wage. I think he focused on Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which raised their minimum wages. And as I remember the study, he didn't find the job loss that he expected to find. Is that not still sort of thought of as a valid sort of empirical look at this proposition of costing jobs?
Well, let me respond in two ways. First of all, I think it's really important to distinguish minimum wages from what is typically called a living wage. Mm-hmm. The New Orleans law, as you actually said at the outset, is a minimum wage. It's a wage floor that applies to virtually everybody. It excludes a few government workers and a few others. The typical living wage in all the other cities you mentioned, with the exception of Santa Monica, applies to a very narrow group of workers. So when we refer to the past research, it's very important to distinguish between those. There's a ton of work mm-hmm. on minimum wages. There's very little work on living wages. With respect to the study, it was by Alan Krueger and David Carr, two Princeton economists. They looked at New Jersey and Pennsylvania in a period when New Jersey's minimum went up and Pennsylvania's didn't. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, here's sort of a quasi-experiment, as we like to call it, a treatment and a control group. They found, not only did they report that there was no employment loss in New Jersey, they actually found massive employment gains in New Jersey. Economists were incredibly skeptical of this result. And actually, last fall, you're not asking a real objective participant here, because with my co-author Bill Washer, who works at the Federal Reserve Board, we wrote an article looking at their study, and in our view, overturned it. Both our comment, as we call it in the profession, and their reply were published recently in the American Economic Review. So if you want to ask what the evidence really says, you should probably ask a third party. In my view, though, that study simply doesn't hold up.
Yeah. Robert Polin, how about that? Job loss, one of the unintended consequences of living wage movements, that the very people you want to help, you make fewer jobs for them.
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's good that David Newmark acknowledged his own involvement in this debate on the extent of job loss, and he represents a particular position. I think it's fair to say that whether David is correct or his debating opponents, Card and Kruger, are correct, the benefit of that debate was to recognize that the effects on employment, whether they be positive or negative, we're going to be pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be large. And moreover, because those effects, and David described the effects well, but because those effects are small, mm-hmm. in fact, they get swamped by other things that take place in the economy at the same time that those effects might be taking place. For example, in 1997, when the minimum wage went up to $5.15 an hour, there were widespread predictions that this was going to cause a lot of job loss. It didn't, and the reason is the economy was booming then.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, the economy is not booming. Unemployment is higher, but that's not because of the minimum wage. That's not because of the living wage. It's because of the business cycle, because of the recession.
Mm-hmm.
So it's true. I mean, mm-hmm. the logic that David gives you in terms of the businesses
yep.
looking to mm-hmm. substitute when the workers' wages go up, there's basic logic to it, and we all teach it in our classes. But the question, the real question, is how important is it?
Yes.
Not whether there's some logic to it, but
right.
how significant
sure.
is it?
Sure.
And when we're talking about overall cost increases on the order of 1%,
mm-hmm.
such as I uncovered for
mm-hmm.
New Orleans, those effects are going to be small.
Sure.
So that's
the wrong way to think about it, right? I mean, these low-wage workers, if they're
Well,
not
wait
making...
a minute, David. Let me finish.
Okay.
Your listeners should know that I recommended David come on to debate me, so we've been through this before.
Sure.
But the point is that the benefits of this kind of relatively modest wage increase are going to be concentrated among low-wage workers,
yeah.
and that's the good part.
Mm-hmm, sure.
There are costs. There's no question
yeah,
that
yeah,
there are costs.
Right.
But the costs are going to be widely dispersed,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to entail small adjustments
right.
among consumers and among the businesses.
We've got that. David Newmark, the work ethic, this is something basic to the American consciousness. Our country, to a certain extent, is premised on the work ethic. Isn't it an insult to the work ethic to offer someone less money to work full-time than, and in other words, the person can work full-time at that $5.15 an hour and still not be able to provide for his family. In fact, be earning way under the poverty line. Isn't that a reproof to something very basic about the American character, that if you work for a living, you should be able to provide a competence?
I don't think you'll get any disagreement from anyone across the spectrum of views here that it would be terrific if I think Bill, paraphrasing something Bill Clinton said a while back, if no one who works should have to live in poverty, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is how do you do it? Okay. Now, what a minimum wage does is essentially tax the use of low wage labor, right? If we were on here talking about trying to reduce smoking, I would bet you'd have guests who would say, "Well, we should tax cigarettes,
right.
thereby raise the price and thereby discourage smoking." This does the same thing. I want to make two points. First of all, I think it's very important when you have political debates not to focus on a number without thinking about what it says carefully. Professor Pollan just mentioned this 1% figure, and I interrupted, and what I was going to say was, if a low-wage worker is currently making $5.15 and his wage is now, or her wage is now forced up to $6.15, that's nearly a 20% increase in the cost of that labor relative to labor that is a slightly more skilled worker who's already making above the $6.15.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be very careful not to latch onto what might be the wrong number again in terms of substitution effect.
Sure.
But the other thing you want to ask is, well, if I say it's people who work shouldn't be in poverty, what should we do instead? The Earned Income Tax Credit is another way of saying, if you work, we're going to make sure you don't live in poverty.
That is a wage subsidy, right?
It's a little different. It effectively acts like that. If you work, and this is the key, and your family's income is below some level, you get a subsidy. That has two very important consequences. One is it doesn't tax the use of low-wage labor. Mm-hmm. In fact, if anything, it should make it a little cheaper for employers, but that's sort of a second-order effect. But the second thing it does, which I think is the real wisdom of the policy, and it's a policy that has support throughout the political spectrum until you get to the extreme right, which perhaps isn't too surprising. But what is very wise about it is it's based on family income. Mm-hmm. So if you're a poor female head of household, you get a lot of bang for the buck from the EITC. In fact, up to 40%. If you're the teenager of you or me, a more affluent family, you get nothing. And that's probably the way it should be.
So what you're saying is that the figures on the minimum wage, grim as they are and indicting as they seem, don't quite take into account the supplement that comes, say, through the Earned Income Tax Credit to people who are what we would call the working poor.
Correct.
But this mitigates, in a way, it mitigates the effects of the wage. It raises their wages.
It pretty much wipes it out. If you look at
through the tax code,
right? If you look at a chart that would correspond to what Bob Pollan talked about earlier, which is that the real minimum wage has declined a lot, about 40%. If you were to add in the EITC, which isn't for all families but is for the poor families that we're worrying about, it would about offset it. It would look it would be jagged, of course.
Sure,
but we've basically gone. I think one way to look at it is we haven't said screw the working poor.
Yeah.
What we've said is we're going to do this differently.
Let's take a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Roseanne is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Roseanne.
Hi. How are you doing?
Oh, we're fine.
I've worked in Pennsylvania and I've worked in Ohio, and Ohio has a living wage law, and I'm all for it because when you're working for minimum wage, you're basically a slave. You feel like a slave. You live like a slave. I went through a period of time where I was getting maybe one decent meal a week. There was no money in the budget left over for anything frivolous like a movie. You know, I used to laugh when I'd see people, you know, you should budget for a movie in your weekly budget. There wasn't even food budgeted. You know, it was just a very meager, got to claw my way through each week to survive kind of mentality. And when you make more, you feel better about yourself. The product that you're making on the line is better. I think the manufacturers, a lot of them have boats and nice, pretty luxury cars, and they're, you know, wearing expensive suits, and I'd like to see them live on minimum wage. They couldn't do it.
Try it as an experiment.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, just see what it feels like to go a week with a quarter in your pocket.
Robert Pollan, how about that? Life as a minimum wage worker, pretty rough.
Well, I think those comments are very important, and they reflect on the position that David Newmark was taking with respect to the Earned Income Tax Credit. There are a lot of points that can be made, but the most important one is that these two things are not direct substitutes. For example, the reason your caller just said, earning your wage is part of how you think of yourself as a person. This came out very clearly in the whole debate about welfare reform. I mean, whatever one's position on welfare reform in the 1996 debate was, that people did want to work for a living, and they didn't want to take so-called government handouts. They wanted to go to work, but they also wanted to earn a decent wage. And so the whole notion of the wage as being part of your sense of yourself as providing dignity and the result being that you are more committed to your job, and so that the problems of absenteeism and turnover are reduced when you have a decent wage is very important. So I think those comments were extremely useful.
Let's take another call. Kurt is on the line. Hello. Kurt?
Yes, I'm here. I'm fortunately on a cell phone.
Well, okay. Welcome.
My point was is that the Earned Income Tax Credit looks like effectively to me that is a subsidy provided by all taxpayers to help corporations make a higher profit margin instead of paying people higher wages. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that came into being in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s?
1980s.
70s with
there were wage subsidies earlier.
Yeah, remarkable how the manufacturing has been declining since that time period where all the high-paying jobs were prior to that. And I'll listen to the response offline. Thanks.
Can I jump in there?
David Newmark, go ahead.
I don't think there's a lot of reasons for the decline in manufacturing, and to some extent it's unfortunate, but I don't think that's the connection. I mean, the EITC is not a payment to firms. There were wage subsidy programs, which I believe is what the call is referring to, and that was basically a payment to a firm to hire a particular set of workers. The EITC does go to the taxpayer. In response to the earlier comment, it's not exactly analogous to welfare. Welfare, the thing that bugged people about welfare was that you get paid to not work, and if you work, you could lose it. Mm-hmm. So it had the types of incentives that when people really sat and thought about it, eventually the country reached more or less a consensus that this was probably not the best way to do things, although it addresses the problem of someone who can't work, for example, because they have young children. The EITC you get when you work. No question, a higher wage brings more dignity. I have no problem with that with that claim, and anyone who objects to that really isn't human. You know, the issue is, as economists, which the two of us are, what's the best way to achieve it? And I think I want to get the other point about absenteeism and turnover. It's an argument I hear a lot, and I always get a little suspicious of it. Now, if we think firms are stupid, which is entirely possible, but if we I don't think it's the case. If we think firms are stupid, then we can say, you know, if we go and make you pay a higher wage, you're going to find that turnover falls and morale goes up and absenteeism goes down, and you're going to be better off. But we tend to think, and most economists tend to think this way, that firms are pretty good at one thing, and that is making money. And if they really thought that would help, they would do it in advance. And we have firms that pursue what we call high wage policies. They have, for whatever reason, the market they're in, the types of workers they use. Xerox was a famous example for a long time. Decided, you know, it really pays to treat our workers well, to pay them a lot, because in our industry, for example, turnover is very costly.
But
in a fast food restaurant, bottom line is they want high turnover.
Yeah. Right? Robert Polin, how about the point that Kurt raises that the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, which comes from all taxpayers, is a kind of, even if it doesn't go directly to the corporation, is a kind of covert subsidy to the corporation because it lets some of the pressure that the worker might otherwise bring for a higher wage, it lets some of that pressure off.
Yeah, well, actually, I completely agree with that point that Kurt made and that you restated well. I'm not against the Earned Income Tax Credit. I think it is a useful policy, and it should be considered as a complement to a decent minimum wage, not as a substitute for a decent minimum wage. The reason it shouldn't be a substitute for the decent minimum wage is exactly what Kurt said. If it is a substitute for a decent minimum wage, it ends up that the taxpayers are subsidizing businesses so that they can pay extremely low wages, and the rest of us make sure that the low-wage workers are not living in total destitution with their families. That's not a good policy. It puts too much pressure. If you have an extremely low minimum wage, it puts too much pressure on the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Hold on one second, David Newmark. We're debating the living wage this hour on On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, and you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're debating the living wage this hour. The proposition that Americans need to be paid to get up to poverty, that the minimum wage will not even get you to the poverty line, and therefore we need a living wage. New Orleans has passed an ordinance requiring everyone in this, all employers in the city, to pay all their help a dollar more an hour. We're talking with Robert Polin, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, and David Newmark, professor of economics at Michigan State. Jolena is on the line. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just calling because I agree with what the gentleman was saying at the end of the break last time.
just because the earned income tax credit is a break at the end of the year. You get money at one point during the year. But that's not going to do anybody any good if they can't make their monthly payments throughout the year. If they can't keep their expenses up, if they can't pay their electric in December, the earned income tax credit isn't going to do them any good if they're not eating in May.
And in other words, Jolena, the earned income tax credit only comes to them after they file their income tax returns in April. Is that it?
Correct.
And so they don't have it for the rest of the year.
Well, you know, if they were able to, if it was able to be put into their salaries throughout the entire year,
yes,
then maybe it would be helpful to them.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have an emergency in September, they have to go to the emergency room, and the money's gone
mm-hmm.
because they've had to outfit their children to go
yeah.
to school the next year.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're trying to help pay tuition for a student. It doesn't do that much good. Granted, it does a lot of good,
yes,
and I wouldn't take that away from any family who needs it.
Mm-hmm.
But there does need to be a living wage. Otherwise, you know, you're living in poverty throughout the year, and then you get this huge sum of money in April.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do with it? Are you going to start a 401k, or are you going to, you know, pay off a $500 emergency room visit because your daughter had tonsillitis?
Right, right. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Jolena. How about that, David Newmark, that there's a subtlety in this, in the way this is given? The EITC is a portion that really makes it harder for people than it should. I mean,
you can get the living wage monthly. I mean, sorry, excuse me, you can get the EITC monthly.
You can get it
yes,
monthly.
Yes, you can. It's very interesting, actually, that Jolene would raise that point. Employers are required to offer it, and they're actually also required to make that information publicly available, because this type of argument has frequently been made in policy circles. The interesting thing is that most people choose not to take it that way. There's some very interesting research that came out recently, actually some surveys, interviews with EITC-eligible families, and try to basically get to the root of that. Why don't you take it monthly?
Mm-hmm.
Don't
mm-hmm.
you face the kind of problem Jolena raised? And actually what the conclusion this study came to is that people are using their EITC for big expenses. For you and I, the notion of putting away money to save up for a car or something is perhaps a little bit of pinching, but really no big deal. But if you're a relatively poor family living paycheck to paycheck and deciding which bills to pay, the notion of somehow having $2,000 or $3,000 socked away by the end of the year to buy a half-decent used car is just seems absurd. And, for example, one thing the study found was that many EITC recipients prefer to let that money essentially build up in a bank account they couldn't touch. That's one way to think about
yeah.
it. And then it's sort of what we call a forced saving device.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the tax year, get this lump sum, which can be quite sizable. Even if you're making $15,000, it can be many, many thousands of dollars, and go out and, for example, buy the car. And we kind of,
yeah.
the economists are coming to the realization that perhaps one of the best jobs programs we could have is to give people cars.
give them cars so they can go to where the jobs are.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Jolena really implicitly raises a question here about information, doesn't she? I mean, the EITC is not taken advantage of by as many people as should. Isn't that correct, Bob Paul?
Yeah, I mean, the evidence there is actually pretty mixed as to the percentages of households that are taking the EITC. Some figures place it at pretty low in various municipalities, like 10-15%. I don't actually trust those numbers as being that low. But the overall point is this. Yeah, your wage is something you get directly. It's, again, it's part of your self-identification. It's the way you think about yourself. It's the way you think about your job. The EITC is a government subsidy. You may get it on a monthly basis if you know how to file it in that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
You could get it at the end of the year. It is a useful program.
Sure.
I don't want to suggest
right. no,
that
of course.
I'm opposed to
mm-hmm.
the EITC.
Mm-hmm.
But the EITC is not a substitute for people getting decent wages.
Right.
It shouldn't be thought of that
right.
way. It
right.
should be thought of as a compliment.
Right, right. Thank you, Jolene, for that call. Bruce is on the line. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
Thanks for putting me on.
Well, glad to have you.
I have a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if someone wants to work for a certain wage and someone wants to employ them for that wage, why can't they do that? Why is that behavior criminalized? It seems like that's a very straightforward economic transaction. I want to do a certain task, and I'm willing to accept $5 an hour or $4 an hour, and someone is willing to say, okay, that sounds good to me, I'll pay you $4 or $5 an hour, why does the government have to get involved and say, no, no, that's bad, you can't do that, that's like stealing or violence, crime, it's terrible, you can't do it.
So you question the basic philosophical premise of the minimum wage, right?
I do.
That the market
I
should
do.
Set the wage.
I think that it's disingenuous to talk about families of four living on these wages when I think probably most of the people are single people, and, you know, you're just going to make jobs more difficult for them to get. Now, the employer has to pay Social Security, he's got to pay unemployment insurance, he's got to pay disability insurance. Mm-hmm. The real costs to him are obviously higher, and every time you raise that bar, you're going to put people out of work. We've been lucky, we've had very good times, but as soon as we get a recession, these sorts of pie-in-the-sky socialist programs are going to really spike the unemployment up much higher than it would otherwise be.
Yeah. All right. Socialist program, Robert Polin. How about that? The minimum wage, to say nothing of the living wage.
Well, it's just factually incorrect that when we have a decent minimum wage that you have higher unemployment. I cited the number of $8.15 an hour in 1968. The unemployment rate then was about 3.5%. So it's not true that, you know, this necessarily spikes the unemployment rate high. There are other factors that come into play here. And, in fact, your caller mentioned the most important, which is recessions are the thing that raises unemployment, and expansions are the things that lowers the unemployment rate. Right. Now, what about the philosophical question? Should there be any limits on what people decide should be the wage given to a worker? Well, I think there should be. And the reason there should be is that people that have to take low-wage jobs have very little bargaining power. Mm-hmm. And so this is a measure that gives them some backing in terms of bargaining power so that they don't.
Of course.
Yes, they would take a job often at $4 an hour or less.
At hunger levels.
If they have to take any job.
Right.
And for the very same reason, we have things like occupational health and safety laws, mm-hmm. which hopefully prevent the worst excesses of unsafe working conditions.
Let's get one more call in if we can. David is on the line. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Good. Can you be brief?
Yes, very brief. I just wanted to ask your guests how our immigration policy works with keeping wages down and keeps us from investing in the people who are
Got it. David Newmark, can you give the short course on that one?
But the short course is it's very hard to get a decisive answer on that question. There's some case that the lowest wage workers suffer some from immigration, but the thing that people always forget, like the fact they forget the fact that minimum wages might cost jobs, is when people come, they not only bring their labor supply, they bring their demands. So the same people who come and do compete for jobs also come and spend money. And so, as we say in economics, supply shifts out and demand shifts out. And that's, I think, why it's very hard to find any strong evidence that immigration is a bad thing. And we have to remember, immigration has a lot of benefits, too.
Sure. George Borges at Harvard finds that it does actually boost lower wages for Native American workers. But that's a point of statistical debate, I suppose. Bob Pollan, do you want to say something briefly on immigration?
Well, I basically agree with what David Newmark said, that there, you know, immigrants do also come and buy things, and they buy things in our communities. And beyond that, there is, again, talking about broader philosophical issues, people come here as immigrants because they're looking for a decent living standard. And so I certainly encourage them and hope that they find what they're looking for. And we need to set social policies that are beneficial to Native people as well as immigrants. And the immigrants included members of my own family. And most of our families, we all came from immigrant families. And so this country is committed to welcoming immigrants and creating a decent environment where they can get decent jobs.
As Eleanor Roosevelt said to the daughters of the American Revolution, fellow immigrants, Thank you, Robert Poland, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and David Newmark, thank you, professor of economics at Michigan State University.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you for joining us. For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Much of the world watching the Olympics in Utah, Salt Lake City has piqued the curiosity of outsiders. Nancy Borgenick directs an acting company in Salt Lake. Her theater is currently staging a collection of short works by Utah writers that present a picture of her city more diverse than the one most outsiders share.
I'm Nancy Borgenick. I'm one of the executive producers of the Salt Lake Acting Company. We produce a season of new plays. Always. That's the mission of the theater. And 2 years ago, in 2000, we thought, the world is coming. What do we do? Should we close the doors? Should we leave town? Should we rent the building for millions of dollars? That's what people say is going to happen. Or should we produce something? Will anyone come? Do we care? And ultimately, I think we just decided to stay true to the mission of the theater. And so, yes, we wanted to produce something that was indigenous to us, that celebrated Salt Lake, Utah voices, Utah writers, Utah actors, in a way that was for our own audience. And if visitors came, great, but if not, we were going to have a good time. I think that we wanted to say, this is home, and we love it. This is home, and it has some strange eccentricities, but it's who we are, and it's made us. And there are things in this kind of silly play sometimes that are spiritual and redemptive and graceful and funny and insane. And if visitors came, if the world came, they would see who else we were. Because there are perceptions about this place, and I think that the Olympics work best in a place that needs to be accepted and loved and has some kind of chip on the shoulder about, oh, please, please like me and see how we're like everyone else. And Salt Lake is a town in search of its identity, because it's really a divided place in a way. About a lot of things, from liquor laws to having fun. It's exciting that the world is here, but I have this strange disconnect. It's kind of like they've come here, but I'm watching them on television have this good time, and they've sort of used my house, but they don't want me to park. And I do feel proud and detached from it. It's a little schizophrenic experience. And it's only a week, and I'm really tired. Is it over yet?
Nancy Borgenick lives in Salt Lake City. Listeners, we want your story on our program. Radio diaries begin with an email or letter from you. These diaries usually start out as essays that are up to 800 words long. Describe the place where your life intersects with the news. Share your story with us. Send your essays and your ideas by email to onpoint.wbur.org or by post to On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Ave, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point from WBUR, Boston.
This is WBU.